The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, everyone. Well done for making it out in very cold, or not, it's actually not so cold, but at least middle of winter. As you know, this is the third in our three-part series, Jesus Sui Generis, and today's title, Solitary Splendor. Now, you may notice one thing is absent on your desks. That's because we have such high esteem of your ability to retain what Ian will be saying, hence there is no outline in front of you. But we will be looking at a part of the Gospel of John chapter 11. But no doubt, Ian will enlighten us as to the text. So we look forward to hearing part three.
Thank you. I have, if we could just be a little confessional here, which you're not supposed to be in this sort of venue, but Peter and I are both feeling, I think, a little bit like those ducks that are looking calm, or a swan, serene on top of. There have been a few organisational problems this morning, so it's clear that we need a break on Thursday mornings, and I'm sorry that you'll have to have one too. Just if anyone would like to borrow this, this is an interesting set of movies that have been made. This is the John's Gospel one, where they only use the actual script of John's Gospel as the screenplay, which means it doesn't work all that well sometimes, because, you know, a screenplay is quite a different bit of writing to the gospel. But I have found it quite illuminating at times when you watch, sometimes particularly when you hear the size of Jesus' statements, and then you see him being just acted out by a little human being, which is what he was, a very unimpressive looking man. So if anyone would like to borrow that, it's but I'm not going to be offended if you don't, by the way. If you see it sitting out here, don't borrow it, because I'll feel lonesome. But it is a fine piece of work. Now, there was an Anglican some hundreds of years ago called John Owens, one of England's great thinkers, a clergyman. He was dying. One of my favourite stories, and I remember when I first read it, is where John Owens is dying. He has a secretary writing letters for him, and he writes, "Dear so-and-so, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the living, as we call it." Then he paused for a moment and then said to his secretary, "No, cross that out, begin it again. Dear so-and-so, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the dying. I hope soon to arrive in the land of the living." Now, there's a brutal realism about that, that as Bob Dylan says, "Them's not busy being born, are busy dying." And there's this, that's who we are. And Ernst Becker, a man that we've mentioned in the past, and is a personal favourite of Dick Gross, one of Australia's better-known atheists, has written a whole serious book that it was published just before he died of cancer, called The Denial of Death, where he argues that our determination in our culture in particular to forget the one reality about ourselves that we shouldn't forget, or one of the realities we shouldn't forget, is one of the marks of our culture. It energises our culture, this whole attempt to deny and to forget the fact that we are those who are dying. Heard the phrase again, land of the dying, when Paul Adzinger, a reasonably good golfer in the top 10 for about 6 years, was one of those horrible Americans that beat Greg Norman in the playoff a number of times for one of the great golf tournaments that he should have won. He also used the phrase when he was diagnosed with cancer, a Christian gentleman. Sam Newman, of course, a role model for so many of us, and not a bad footballer at some stage, but generally speaking, a bit of a goose. You may remember he reported these words on television. He said, "The best news I've ever heard in all my life." And what's he talking about? This very light-hearted, strong, sort of heroic-looking character. "The best news I ever heard in all my life was the words of his surgeon when he'd had some prostate cancer operation, where the doctor said to him, 'I reckon we nailed it.'" And, of course, the difficulty with that being the best news, that is simply a sort of a stay of proceedings. Of course, in the end, Sam Newman still gets to die. But just when it's delayed, when it's suddenly forced into our consciousness, as various things will happen to you, when suddenly you are made aware of the inevitability of you as being in the land of the dying, Even a stay of execution feels like we, you know, a whole new life, but it's always delaying the inevitable. And in a sense, funerals. I hate taking funerals. When I was at Barney's, at sort of a university church, the exciting thing there was he did very few funerals, but all the funerals were horribly tragic. They were either babies or young people. And one of the most memorable services I ever saw at Barney's was the last funeral we took, which was of a young mother, two lovely kids, a lovely husband. In a sense, died of cancer because she wasn't a whinger. She'd given birth, she wasn't feeling well. She was not a whinger, so she didn't go to the doctor, just thought, well, my body's readjusting. And by the time she went to the doctor, it was discovered she had cancer, which eventually killed her. We were very thankful that she had much longer than she should have had, because her fear was that her kids would have no memory of her. And it seems like a small blessing, but it was a great blessing that she, well, as the doctor said, everyone else who was diagnosed with that sort of cancer has been dead for years before she finally died. But in the end, funerals are amongst the most ordinary events on the planet. Just generally speaking, each one specifically is a horror, or most of them. But they're just ordinary. All sorts of people, every person dies. So there'll be all sorts of people heading off to various crematoriums and churches for funerals today. It's a very ordinary, mundane, sort of tedious sort of event. And the story we have in John 11 is of one of those events. It's a friendship, it's sickness, it's a family, it's death, it's tears. It's the attempt to find some comfort. The word of comfort that was offered amongst most of the Jews in the first century was, he will live again. He will rise again at the resurrection of the last day. It was to do with that. So some years ago, the general statement said at funerals would be something like, he's gone to a better place. Now, we're almost too frightened to speak of that, and we just say he had a good innings or something like that. Or if he died young and drunk, you say, well, at least he died doing something he liked. We try to make some sense of it. And the word that was said at most Jewish funerals was about, well, he will rise again on the resurrection. A view that most of the Jews, not all the Jews, had that at the end of history, not anywhere before that, there would be a general resurrection. And bodily life would be restructured, and relationships would be remade, and shalom and peace and joy would come in. In John 11, a story which you've not just sat, unfortunately what we lost this time is we had almost the whole chapter for you, so we could just read through the whole chapter, but it'll be better if you just take it home, give yourself 10 minutes at work, lock yourself in the toilet, wherever you do your serious reading, and just read it for 10 minutes from beginning to end. It's a beautiful story, well told, all sorts of little crazy details that pop up because it's the story of an eyewitness. John 11. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. How exciting. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one that you love is sick. Jesus is on the other side of the Jordan River. He's about 40 kilometres away, sort of in hiding, because his enemies are increasingly threatening him with death. It's mostly an uphill walk to Bethany, which is right beside Jerusalem. And he gets the message, Lord, the one you love is sick. Now, you know what they're doing with that, don't you? They're not just informing Jesus, they're asking Jesus to do something. They're clearly assuming that since he loves Lazarus, since he's often been in their home, and since he's often is obviously friends with Lazarus, he'll do what friends do. I mean, if you've got a friend who's sick, you'll probably visit them. If you have friends who are seriously sick and don't visit them, start visiting them. It's a thing which people should do with their friends who are sick. But this guy's sick, and obviously they're asking him to visit and heal. If you read the story, it's quite bizarre because Jesus deliberately waits till Lazarus is dead. He deliberately won't help. He deliberately allows the hearts of Mary and Martha to be broken and allows Lazarus to slip off into the darkness. But then he says to his friends in verse 11, after he said this, he went on to say to his disciples, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up. Now, you may get that statement about what death is as sleep. That is, as I understand it, a fairly Christian way of speaking about death. As I understand the Latin origins, the word cemetery comes from the Latin word dormitory. And it's a peculiarly Christian way of seeing death as sleep. So Jesus says, Lazarus is asleep, and his disciples think, hang on, why would you walk 40 kilometres to wake someone up who's asleep? That's a very expensive alarm clock. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I'm glad. This is, well, really, that's appropriate. Lazarus is dead, he's Jesus' friend, he's their friends, but Jesus' next statement is about the fact that he's glad. I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So off they go. Thomas suggests they not go because last time he was in that part of the world, they were trying to kill him. But Jesus turns up at this very tedious, ordinary event, but he's a very unusual guest. One of the ways in which he's unusual, I don't know how you feel when you go to funerals of someone who you love, or sometimes even more difficultly, someone who you love who's lost someone close to them. As a person who's been in parish ministry in various forms, I've probably been to more funerals than most. I used to be, entertained, but it was more irritated by an old man I knew who used to say to me, well, those of us who live in the real world, assuming I wasn't, and once I said to him, how many dead bodies have you sat beside in the last 50 years? How many suicide, places of suicide have you been to? You think working in an insurance company and living on the northern beaches puts you in touch with the real world more than... I don't think so. But I still don't know what to say at funerals. I go and I know I should say something. I know I should communicate in some way. But if I have half a decent excuse to not have to talk to the people involved, I'll take it. I'm a coward, really. But in the end, Jesus goes to this funeral with a very unusual mindset. He knows Lazarus is barely dead. Well, he's 4 days dead, which means he died on Sunday for us, which is thoroughly well and truly dead. And the Jews had this view that somehow or other the spirit, or at least some of them did, kind of hung around the place of death for about 3 or 4 days before it finally left and went to wherever it went to. So 4 days dead is like, that's it, baby, it's over. And Jesus turns up. He encounters the two sisters who respond to Jesus very differently, but absolutely in harmony with the way you'd expect from the other snippets we get of Mary and Martha. Remember, Martha's the one who ticks Jesus off for not ticking her sister off because her sister was pretending she was a boy. Her sister was sitting at the feet of Jesus, and you weren't allowed to do that if you're a woman. You're supposed to be in the kitchen. I'm not agreeing with that, but I'm saying we know that's what the culture was, and it still is in many cultures. The men can sit down around the feet of the religious teacher. The women in the kitchen preparing food. That's their part of the job. Martha's playing hostess, and her lazy younger sister, I presume she's youngest, what younger sisters and younger brothers do, being the youngest of five, okay, I'm not having a go at anyone who's young. The younger ones leave the older ones to do the responsible stuff. Martha's cranky with Jesus. She ticks Jesus off for not ticking Mary off. And this is exactly, they're both true to character here. Martha hears Jesus come, she runs out to engage him in conversation. Mary doesn't, but as soon as Jesus calls for Mary to come, she goes quickly. There's a tenderness and a contemplativeness about Mary and a no-nonsenseness about Martha, which we see in this story too when you get a chance to read it. And they have this little interchange when Martha gets to see Jesus. Verse 21 of John's account. Lord, Martha said, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Lord, if you'd been here, instead of staying where you were, my brother would not have died. Mary says exactly the same thing when she sees Jesus. Word for word, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. It seems clear the sisters had talked about this. They'd sent a message to Jesus, he hadn't come. They'd sent a message to Jesus, and the messengers got back to their place without Jesus. Jesus comes a few days later. It's all too late. Why? Why is Jesus so disappointing? Why does Jesus not do the obvious? I mean, sure, if you've been a person who's been hanging around with Jesus for some time, you'll know how disappointing God is. How often he doesn't do the obvious. He doesn't answer the most obvious prayer that would clearly be the right and the good thing to do. Lord, the one who you love is sick. Where were you? Martha sort of, it'd be interesting to know how she said it, the tone of voice. Then Jesus answers with a platitude. your brother will rise again. I wonder if Mary didn't think, maybe she kind of hoped for a little more from Jesus than you know, he's gone to a better place. Your brother will rise again. Martha says, I know he will rise in the resurrection at the last day. Long time off. Right here, right now, my heart is broken. Then Jesus says these, I don't know what words to use for it, but he gives these words that are simply without parallel anywhere in the writings of anyone in history. Whether it be from India or Nepal or from Arabia or America, no one says words like this. I have to read these words out at funerals. And frankly, I feel a bit silly sometimes. I read out these words from Jesus. Right next to me is a coffin with a dead body in it. But here's what Jesus says. She says, I know he'll rise again, the resurrection of the last day. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even though they die. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? I just play with, what does Jesus mean when he says, I am the resurrection? The resurrection is an event. There were three things that the Jews were very clear that God would not share with the Messiah. The right to give life, the right to judge the dead, and the right to raise the dead. They were God alone prerogatives. Jesus calmly says, the future that you wait for is standing in front of you. The event that you hope for is a person. I am the resurrection. It's a very peculiar way to speak. I'm the resurrection. And the word resurrection means, almost literally means, the standing up of the corpse. One of the attempts to avoid the embarrassment sometimes of the idea of the resurrection of Jesus, him walking out bodily from the tomb, or the resurrection that Jesus does, is to say it's all just spiritual, it's all a metaphor of life triumphing over death, of love triumphing over hatred, all that sort of stuff. The problem is the word resurrection means, quite literally, the standing up of a corpse. Jesus is saying, I am the one who rises corpses up. I am the reverser of death. Because every funeral you go to is a party, being held by that most violent, enduring, imperial tyrant of death. We don't like to think about it, but Sam Newman, I think he's still alive. In the end, Sam Newman will just go down as one more casualty of death. You will. I will. My mother will. My children will. Everyone gets eaten up by death. I expect reasonably soon, perhaps, to stand beside my mother's casket. She's 91. But it may be that she will stand beside my casket. I hope not for her sake, isn't it? I mean, the one thing you want to do if you're a parent is stand beside as few caskets with your children in them as possible. Mum's done it once already. But in the end, death is this great tyrant, and at every funeral, it's our sadness, but it's death's victory. And Jesus, in the middle of this place, says, I'm the resurrection, and I'm the life. We tend to think of the life, or this life that is life indeed, as a combination of a few things: good health, absence of war, financial security, relational harmony, some sort of hope for the future, etc., etc. But Jesus says, all that stuff that you think makes up life, it's me, really. If Jesus is not who he says he is, or even to go even more foolishly, if, as one or two writers suggest, without any historical basis, that perhaps Jesus didn't exist, there is an extreme literary genius running around in the first century, not only making up whiz-bang parables that are without, have not been bettered in 2,000 years, but coming up with even the form of the statement, I am. This is pretty much without parallel, and yet, as you know, Jesus makes seven of them. Seven great I am statements. I am the bread of life. Can you imagine if I said that to you? Friends, I've got a revelation to tell you. I am the bread of life. Are you hungry? Is there some sort of internal need? Come to me. Eat me. I'm the light of the world, Jesus says. Really? I'm the door. You want to get into eternal life? It's me. I'm the good shepherd. Oh, I thought God was the good shepherd. No, Jesus, I'm the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep. I'm the true vine, Jesus says. I am the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life, and here, I'm the resurrection. That great hope of the triumph over death, Jesus, it's me, and it's right here, right now in front of you. It's an extraordinary statement. So, I mean, I think there's no reason to think it doesn't come straight out of the lips of Jesus. But if you don't have Jesus, you've still got the problem of finding some other creative genius who makes up words for an imaginary character, which frankly surpassed anything old Shakespeare could come up with, and he wasn't too bad with words either. But it's an extraordinary statement, and I was saying to my wife as she was driving me in here, because I was running so late this morning, I said, one or two of my atheist friends, they seem to be unable even to concede the brilliance of Jesus' words, which makes me suspicious either they are totally deaf or that there is such a determination to stay free of the sovereignty of God that they can't bear to acknowledge the sui generis of this man, the solitary splendor of this man who makes such extraordinarily beautiful, happy, joy-bringing or ridiculous claims. I am the resurrection, I am the life. That's the claim. Then there's an expression of the benefits and how it works. Anyone who believes in me, anyone who trusts in me, will live, even though they die. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. So what he's saying is, whether death is behind you, as it is with Lazarus, or whether or not death is in front of you, it's no problem, because what you will have in me is life and resurrection. Your life will all be about life. You'll be in the land of the living. You'll need to have a little sleep before you arrive perfectly in the land of the living. But that's where you are. And then the challenge at the end, do you believe this? With Jesus, it's never just a statement of, you know, write down your creed, what you think to be true about me. But it's always calling for a verdict. Because faith, I think one of the most helpful ways to understand faith, it's a verdict. It's a verdict you come to about Jesus. It's a decision you make. And Jesus says who he is. He expresses then the benefits of who he is. And then calls Mary and us to a challenge to whether or not we're going to believe it. But words are cheap, aren't they? Words are easy. It's easy to talk a good game. But Jesus is in it. He's made these words at a funeral. It's a bit like when Jesus asked the question with a cripple in front of him, what is easier, to say your sins are forgiven or rise up and walk? You know when Jesus says that in Mark 2? Well, of course it's easier to say your sins are forgiven. Why? Can't be tested. But if you've got a cripple in front of you, your capacity to turn words into deeds is easily testable. Jesus is at a funeral. But before we get to see the way in which he validifies his words, there's a moment, as I promised in the email, that we'd have a tiny look into the inner life of Jesus. We're much more concerned, I think, about the inner life of Jesus and all sorts of characters, even footballers. We joked about that nonsense, you know, when they ask a footballer, how do you feel? At which point, change the channel, because the next few sentences are going to be meaningless and worthless. They've got no idea how they feel except for start. Oh, mate, words fail me. They're fantastic. Thank you so much for that. But we do have here an extraordinary window in this story into the heart of Jesus. And the significance of that is this is that Jesus says, if you've seen me, who have you seen? He says, if you've seen me, you've seen God. So when we look at the inner life of Jesus, I take it we're seeing the inner life of God. So what happens when Jesus goes through funeral? Even though he knows he's going to have afternoon tea with Lazarus, Mary comes out. Jesus does not engage her in theological discussion. She comes out, runs out when Jesus calls her, grabs his, you know, falls at his feet, and says this about Jesus. She says, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. The Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? There's this phrase which we've discussed in another context with you, deeply moved in spirit. If ever you get offered a chance at your local church or a local TAFE to do a New Testament Greek course, I'd suggest don't bother doing it. I'm glad I had a chance to learn New Testament Greek, but fundamentally the translations are so good that it's pretty much a waste of time. If you get a chance to learn ancient Hebrew, that's worth doing, I think, because the gap between Hebrew and English is so substantial, but the gap between English and Greek is quite small. And all the quandary parts in how you translate one language are normally in the footnotes. But this is one part where the English translators have been universally cowards. Well, that's not true. The Holman translation has come out, which finally translates this clearly. Luther translates it clearly from when he translates the Bible from Greek to German, the first man to do that. And he uses the German word, which I don't know what it is, when it says deeply moved in spirit, when he saw her weeping, the Jews also weeping, he was angry in his spirit, is the word. It's very clearly angry. But people don't translate it as angry because they feel as if it looks at Jesus angry with... And the word's got a range of meanings, you know, as every word does, but it's a cowardly act. We don't like the fact that Jesus... It looks as if he's angry with Mary and those who are weeping with her, but he's not. He sees them weeping. The next verse is, Jesus wept. When he fronts up before the tomb, again, in verse 38... When he's at the tomb, he is again angry. You want to know what God feels like when you go to the funeral of your mother or of a child or of a friend who you love and you see the horror? It seems to be quite clear here what God feels, what Jesus feels, is anger, and he weeps. He weeps with those who weep, as we're commanded to do. In all our distress, he too is distressed, the Bible says. He weeps with you in your sadness. And he's angry at death, because death is the enemy. Death is a bastard. Death is a brute. The more you love someone, the more you feel the horror of it. Even if the person is, like when my old man died, it was a good death in a sense. He died easily. He died the way he'd always said he'd like to die. And he died full of years. But it would still be much better if he didn't die. You know, if he could still be around and healthy, which he couldn't be. You want to see into the heart? How does God feel at funerals? He weeps with those who weep, and he's angry at death, and he'll do something about it. They say, see how he loved him. They think Jesus is weeping because he's sad because Lazarus has died. He's not. Lazarus is having a nap as far as Jesus is concerned. Do you cry when your children are asleep? Ha! Right? If you've had children, you know you cry when they don't go to sleep. Right? When they're asleep, it's beautiful. If you'd go and visit a friend and they're asleep, you don't cry. If you're me, you ask permission to sneak in and wake them up as violently and as unpleasantly as possible. But Jesus, he has not lost Lazarus. But Mary and Martha and the friends think they have. So he is moved. He weeps with those who weep. Then the whole story, roll away the stone. Martha says, don't. There'll be a terrible odour as there would have been. And then as St. Augustine says, writes, you know, about 400 years after Jesus in North Africa, he describes when Jesus says, Lazarus here, which is not good English, it's not even good Greek, it lacks a verb, but he's basically saying to him, Lazarus here. Augustine says he rightly has to specify who he wants out, otherwise everyone else in that tomb would have got out as well. You know, Eliphaz, Joshua, Bob, Fred, Peter, stay where you are for now. Just Lazarus, please, Lazarus here. And then it would have been great. It's well done, this movie. You're peering into the tomb and then suddenly there's a sign of movement and out shuffles Lazarus. Thankfully, the Jews didn't do what the Egyptians did. They didn't pull half the organs out through the nostrils. So he just comes out all bandaged up, shuffling. Classic Jesus. He then says, untie him. He could just go, shh, and sort of cut them open like in some science fiction movie with some laser finger light, but he doesn't. He does what only he can do and expects us to do what we can do. Raises a little girl from the dead, give her some food. Raises Lazarus from the dead, untie him. Jesus not only speaks words that are unparalleled, but he does unparallel. He actually speaks and overpowers death with a simple word. Notice that he doesn't say, "Dear God, please raise Lazarus from the dead." In the same way as when he talks to the storm and the wind and the waves, he doesn't say, "Dear God, please calm the storm." That's what a prophet would do. He speaks to the wind and the waves. He speaks to the dead and they come up. He has the word. He is the life. He is the resurrection. He is unparalleled. Now we, of course, we'll go one of two ways at this, as the people in Jesus' day did. We're told when it was all over, many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their trust in him. Why wouldn't you? But here's the interesting part. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. They called a meeting. What are we accomplishing? Here is this man performing many miracles. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. It's extraordinary. So some do the obvious. They see the light, they follow. Others see it, they go and report to the powerful authorities that have got control of how things work. And the authorities say, he's doing miracles. He's doing so many. If we don't act, everyone will believe in him. It's exactly what the Bible consistently says is, the light has come into the world, but many people prefer the darkness to the light. Now, don't challenge us too much to think about the evidence. Jesus is without parallel. He goes to the funeral with an attitude no one else does. He speaks absurd words, but beautiful words, joyful words, and then he shows that he has that power. And then he says to you, do you believe it? Are you one who has found that you have in Jesus a friend who will overcome death? So you can look death in the eye, not enjoy the experience, but know that it will just be sleep for you until final resurrection appears at the end of time. Well, let's stop there so there's some time for questions. You might want to yell a question out from the floor as others are writing.
The I am.
Yes, I think the I am is significant, and you can see the significance of it when Jesus uses it in John 8, where they nearly kill him, where he says, before Abraham was, I am. And they try to kill him. It's the name for God. When Moses says, who will I say has sent me? He says in Hebrew, tell them I am has sent you. So this was a phrase that was full, it was just charged with, thank you. It was just charged with meaning. And when Jesus says, I am, and ego, eimi, it's quite, he could say it, the way it's constructed in the Greek, eimi would be enough to say I am. You put the ego in front of it to emphasize the I. So presumably John is communicating to us the way in which Jesus said it. So yes, I think the I am is. But it's like the word Son of Man. It's Jesus doing this thing he does where he's. It can go either way. People might just think he's just making an absurd grand claim for himself. But I think when he says, before Abraham was, I am, that's indicative of the way that he's using it. Now, what did you mean when you said, you will have a little sleep and then arrive in the land of the living? If we're in Christ, do we go immediately after death? Yes. Jesus is the one who starts to speak about death as sleep. Right? It's been tamed. So what will happen if I die today? My understanding is, and Christians do have some differences on this, that I will be, my spirit will be in the presence of Jesus, my body will be in the grave and then burned up or whatever gets done to it. I want to be buried at sea, actually. I think it would be fun. But but the ultimate reunion and of my body and my soul will happen on the last day. Because the Bible never, ever pictures paradise as the spirit floating free, set free of the body. The Bible always says you're a human being. When God made you body, mind, soul, spirit, that was always his intention. That's what he wants for you, and that's what you're going to be in the new heaven, the new earth. I hope that's clear. The Jewish funerals still usually say he or she will rise again. I've only been to one Jewish funeral of a friend of mine's mother, and they did speak of the resurrection of the just. Judaism, as you will probably know, had two clear strands in it. In Jesus' time, the Sadducees didn't believe that there was anything after death. The Pharisees and a few other groups did. Jesus is clearly on the side of the Pharisees at this point. The way you remember that is, I'm sorry to do this to you, the Sadducees didn't believe in life after death, and that's why they were sad, you see. if you want to remember who's who. Sorry about that. I won't do that. In fact, that was such a bad joke, I won't speak for another 3 or 4 weeks. Is there a connection between God's I am to Moses and Jesus' I am? Yes. But it's that subtlety that Jesus uses. Now, where, hang on. Was it normal for women like Mary, Martha and Mary to be in such close rapport with Jesus? Did first century rabbis associate with women? Is this an example of John's writing a witness account of Jesus because it's different from cultural norms? I don't know about all the details of what happened inside Jewish homes. In Islamic homes, in Middle Eastern homes, mostly Islamic homes, that there will be a room for the guests and a room for the women, that they keep them separate even inside the house. I don't think it was quite like that as I understand it from in Judaism, but the roles were very distinct. There's no doubt that when Jesus was travelling around with women in his sort of entourage, that was a bit scandalous. There's no doubt that Jesus treated women in a way that was somewhat shocking in his day, and you would hope that Christians would continue to model that extraordinary honouring of women and not being caught up in accidental sexism. Should we be extending life by artificial means? That's an easy question. No, I think there at one level yes and no. I think that when the headmaster at Shaw had his second heart attack, one of the atheist boys came to me and said, "Explain to me why we're spending so much money on one, you know," I think he called him an old man, but you know, slightly older than me, man. Surely that money could be better spent in Africa. And there's a bit of a puzzle because it is hard to justify, isn't it? But at an emotional level, of course you do what you can for those who are close to you, and he's gone on to have a continually useful life. I think we should do what we can to keep life going, but there's clearly a point where you say, this person needs to die. I think they call it heroic measures. I think there are clearly times in our culture when it's time for someone to die, and we should let them die gracefully. But there are other times when you can keep people alive by all sorts of extreme things, and you can bring them back to healthy life. So I don't think we should be silly, but we certainly should do what we can for those that we know. But there are times when I just don't keep me artificial. Not that I fear the death process so much, I just think whatever money you waste on keeping me alive for an extra 6 months, you don't spend on kids who need help, or you don't spend on researching other diseases. I think it's almost half the health budget in this country is spent on the last few months of life. That, when I heard that, and it was a good source, that seems to me to be unhealthy. But who am I? In what, should I be silent now? In what ways are the I am sections of St. John's Gospel connected with each other? The I am statements seem, most of them, but not all of them, seem to be connected to a miracle. Not all of them. So Jesus, this is the clearest. I am the resurrection. And then, of course, when he himself dies, which is an even better trick, he goes into the belly of the beast and tears it apart and comes back. I am the light of the world is said on the back of the Feast of the Tabernacles, straight after the man who was born blind is healed. There does seem to be a parallel with them. I'm the bread of life is done in the context of Jesus creating bread. So there does seem to be a not military parallel between the statements of Jesus and then his words. Should eulogies be given at funerals? Yes, there was something about this one, wasn't there? Well, I think they're quite good. I just think so long as they're not this sad business of a celebration of life with no acknowledgement of the sadness of death, which happens more and more. Apparently, generations ago, eulogies on the whole weren't given at funerals, I think. It's worth remembering that. It's almost impossible to think of a funeral without a eulogy now. Eulogies are done elsewhere. But I think a eulogy that puts a life unashamedly in the context of God's creation and life and death might have a place. What I think is a shame now is that everyone feels that if their father dies, they have to get up and speak. I think that's a mistake. There's pressure on family members now to speak, when I think many of them just should be mourning, you know, and weeping and doing whatever they do. Last question. That's it. That'll do it.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.